This meeting is now being recorded.
Good afternoon. This is Nancy Burke at the Direct Selling Association. Thank you for participating in DSA Live, DSA's call meant to provide you with the information you need to make the most out of your membership. Please hold your questions until the Q&A period at the end of the presentation. You're also able to ask a question by typing it into the chat box on GoToWebinar. At this point in time, we are ready to begin this conference, and please be aware that this call is being recorded. And now let me introduce DSA's president, Joe Mariano.
Thanks, Nancy. Hi, everybody. This is Joe Mariano. It's such a pleasure to participate in this with you all. I think we have a large number of executives from our Direct Selling Association members. It was a great 2017 for the industry and for the association, a lot of challenges, a lot of opportunities that we've been pursuing. 2018 provides us with the same opportunities and challenges as we go forward. I'm looking forward to a good association year as well as a good report from the industry statistics from 2017 as we move forward. We wanted to take this opportunity as the first DSA Live call for 2018 to brief you on a number of critical and important initiatives that are ongoing from the association and to get your input and feedback on some of those initiatives. You should all see in front of you the agenda for today. We're going to start off with a discussion of an important and critical element of the association's work in support of all of our other agenda items, and that's the DSA research, and I'll introduce that in a second. Some of those other critical action areas that the association is working on include our legislative agenda, both at the state level and, importantly, at the federal level. One of the reasons why DSA is here in Washington, D.C., and how that dovetails closely with our another initiative on ethics and self-regulation. Over the next several years, you will hear those words, legislation, advocacy, and ethics and self-regulation, again and again and again, because those are our clear primary focus as an association and as an industry working group, and so we want to make sure that everyone is up to date and giving input into that. We'll also be talking about not only our anti-pyramid consumer protection legislation, but also touching on some of the issues that are raised by tax reform as recently passed by the Congress. We also then will have an open session for Q&A, as Nancy suggested. So my colleagues here from the association are seated around the table, and hopefully between those folks and other folks in the industry, we will be able to give some value to you over the next 45 minutes or an hour. I mentioned research. I would be remiss if I did not say thank you to all of the folks who participate on our research committee and in our research efforts from the membership. All of you, of course, are volunteers, volunteer leaders, who have in some cases been seconded to the association for work on these important areas. One of those folks is the current chair of our industry research committee. Her name is Judy Jones. Judy has been working not only with Amway but with DSA and the World Federation of Direct Selling Associations for years now on our research and data collection efforts and analysis efforts, and she has proven to be an extraordinary resource on a global basis to what we hope to give to you all in terms of advocacy as well as business intelligence information for your own individual companies. Additionally, Paul Borkwin is a managing economist at Nathan Associates, has worked with us as well for years, at least 20, 25 years, on growth and outlook as well as other research activities, and has provided tremendous insight working with Judy and other members of the committee. A more recent addition to the committee is Jay Schwartz, Executive Director of Insights and Marketing Intelligence of New Avon, who will also be presenting today and has been a great contributor to the association. So, Judy, with that, I'll hand it off to you and say again, thank you, thank you, thank you for all of your continuing efforts on behalf of the industry, not just Amway for whom you work. So I'm looking forward to hearing your description of what's going on in the Evolving Marketplace Survey.
Joe, thank you so much for the introduction, and we do have an exciting program planned for you all today. We'd like to cover two things, mainly. The first is our most recent research results, and the second is the Growth and Outlook Survey, which is now in the field. So let's start with the recent research results on our latest and newest research survey, which we called 2017 the Evolving Marketplace. In line with our research objective overall for this year of providing very actionable insights and research results, we looked at the general topic of relevance and how direct selling can maintain its relevance in the new economy. As Joe said, thanks to all of the companies that participated in this brand new survey, the response rate was 28%, which is very good for a new survey. And what we'd like to do first is look at the objectives. Very specifically, this study looked at how the overall direct selling model is evolving within the context of retailing and the evolving marketplace. Secondly, we know that there is an increase on the focus of consumers both inside and outside the Salesforce network. We looked at that. We looked also at the party plan model in this age of rapidly increasing social media. And finally, at challenges and the opportunities that are posed by technology in the field of e-commerce and the collaborative economy. By the way, the survey was conducted online in September of 2017, and we did have 51 companies responding. Now, let's have a look at some context for the general results of this survey. Direct selling has had great sustained growth in the post-recession period. But you'll notice from this graph that in 2015, the growth slowed to 4.8% from 5.5%. And in 2016, direct sales in the U.S. were actually down by 1.6%. And if we look at the far right-hand side of this slide, you'll see that three-quarters worth of results are showing that we also have a downward trend in 2017, with sales year-to-date at the end of quarter three down 6% and new representatives down 8%. Well, so let's dive in a little bit and see if we can understand that better. On the next slide, you'll see what we call the Amazonification of America. We know the retail marketplace is rapidly evolving, and frankly, companies that don't learn a lot from innovative leaders like Amazon could be left behind. Amazon's key strategies are a very diverse scope of products, but also very easy ordering and fast fulfillment. So a key takeaway from this bit of research is that the transformation of the retail environment should serve as an inspiration for all direct selling companies to invest in technology and really increase the focus on the end consumer and making things very consumer friendly. In fact, in terms of e-commerce, direct selling companies view this field as an immense opportunity. So they're taking an optimistic view of it, and they're taking action to remain competitive. I think our question as the industry research committee is, however, is our industry doing enough? Tune in to the right-hand side of this slide, and we see that companies are taking action to remain competitive, but mainly they're improving their website for consumers at 75%, and improving the website as well for their independent representatives at 73%. And we would think that today these are just the matter, nature of business. And so we ask, is this enough? And then looking at the collaborative economy, there is still a major question as we talk to our companies about the collaborative economy. I think we all haven't quite figured it out yet. Again, looking at the right-hand side of the slide, we again ask ourselves the question, are we doing enough? Because here it's 71% of companies that are improving their websites for their independent reps and 67% who are improving websites for consumers outside the network. those overall are the largest things that our companies are doing to remain competitive. We'll take a deeper dive now as we go into some of the material, and at this point, I'm going to turn things over to Jay Schwartz of New Avon. Jay, over to you.
Thank you, Judy. As we'll see, direct selling is evolving with an increasing focus on consumers on inside and outside the network. However, we have metrics that are missing and various KPIs are needed, particularly on the representative side of the equation. As you'll see in the headline, most companies do not track acquisition and retention costs. As we look at the left-hand side of the page or the consumer side of the page, you'll notice that of the member companies, 8% track acquisition costs of consumers and 4% track the retention cost of a consumer outside of their particular network. Personally, I didn't find these numbers surprising at all. In my experience here at Avon, as well as my experience on the CPG side of the business, we have always found it difficult to track consumer acquisition and retention costs. I'll contrast that with the representative acquisition and retention costs on the right-hand side of the page, which you'll see at 20% and 12% respectively. This, on the other hand, I think is a different story. We should all be able to calculate and track the acquisition and retention cost of a representative, given there's fairly good knowledge of the spend in these various areas, should be fairly straightforward. So I was particularly surprised to see these numbers a little bit lower than I would have anticipated. And to Judy's point about the Insights Committee taking on some questions in the future, there may be an opportunity here maybe for us to work across companies and maybe share a methodology to raise these percentages to some degree. More than half of the companies say they can segment their independent representatives to better differentiate customers from sellers. Typically, the larger companies in the non-party plans are more likely to segment. And I'll draw your attention down to the color boxes below, and I'll kind of start in the middle, that 55% of the companies tell us they're able to tailor communications by segment, which I found very promising. When you're able to tailor your communications by segment, the first thing that tells me is that the segmentation is very actionable and that people are utilizing it, which I think is a great step. Looking over to the left-hand side, 66% of the companies telling us they're able to track sales by segment, which to some degree I think is a byproduct of that middle portion. So if we can tailor our communications and then track sales, that tells us we're really putting segmentations to good use. Half of all the companies have a preferred customer program. And as you'll see in the headline on the right, about 12% have more than one customer preferred program, which I found particularly interesting. The way we defined that in this study was that customers have registered or renewed as a preferred customer for that direct selling company in the past 12 months. They may or may not be eligible to pay wholesale prices depending on the program, and they are, of course, not eligible to sell products. If we look to the middle of the page, half of the participating companies, as I said, have a preferred customer program. And as I think about it, I'd like to focus here for a second. I find this an area where, as an industry, I think we have a lot of opportunity. As I look at myself as a consumer, regardless of the retailer I walk into, I find some sort of customer preferred program, whether that's through a loyalty program that results in promotions, dollars off, whatever it may be. So, you know, moving more into 2018, 2019 and being competitive with other retail brands, I think as an industry we need to strive to get that 49% a little bit higher. And the benefits of preferred customer programs. And from what the 49% the companies tell us, that almost 90% of them offer discounted pricing and a little over half offer special sales or promotions, which I find, again, fairly typical. I'm assuming you as consumers experience the same thing. As we move forward as a direct selling industry, I would hope we can offer more unique solutions in this area, given that we have fairly unique go-to-market strategies. I'd look for the industry to bring more unique solutions to the consumer, and where we can be more unique and different to be able to drive people to direct selling and maybe enhanced preferred customer programs as we move forward. This was a finding on the next page. Who are the customers outside the network that I found particularly interesting? Just over 90% of the companies have access to names of the consumers outside the network, which I think is great. Very, very high number. As we look over to the right, about 3/4 of the companies register consumers and ship directly to them. And how do they get those names? About 43% tell us that independent representatives provide the customer names. One thing I'd like to learn a little bit more about here is that 43%, why is it at 43? Is there somewhat of a reluctance of representatives? I'd go as far as to even ask if there's a trust issue of representatives providing customer names to the corporation or back to the parent company. Importantly, as we look over to the right, 28% reserving the company's right to own the customer relationship in the contract with independent representatives, which again I found fairly surprising. I'm wondering about this arrangement and what does that say about the representative and corporate relationship, the fact that they reserve the right to own the customer relationship. So I'm kind of curious again, a little bit more background on that 28% and the dynamics of that. Moving on, 1/3 of companies actively conduct primary research among consumers outside the network. Similar to segmentation, larger companies are more likely to do so. 1/3 do not take any action to profile consumers outside the network, which, again, I think it's a little bit on the high side. Having access to our consumers beyond just the representatives, I think, is particularly important, the ability to generate insights. So anything we can do to push that number lower in this case, I think would be important. Two-thirds of companies communicate directly with consumers outside the network, and not surprisingly, we see that communication around email, social media, company websites, so I think fairly typical and straightforward methods of communication. So are direct selling companies keeping up with ordering and fulfillment processes? About half the companies allow consumers outside the network to order directly. And for those companies, as we look over to the right side of the page, almost 60% of those orders are assigned to an existing independent representative who's paid the all or some of the commission. 31%, the order is handled as a house account where no commission is paid. And just personally, I was not I wasn't sure quite how to interpret that 58 and that 31%. Somewhere down the road, I would like to hear a little bit more information and background on that as to how that benchmarks. That 31% handling as a house account where no commission is paid, I'd be interested to hear some feedback from the individual companies on how that's talked about internally, just to get some context there. But again, for the future. Is the direct selling industry positioned to compete as far as payment? So how independent representatives are paid? 86% directly deposited into the bank account. 49%, however, where a check is sent in the mail, which, you know, as we think about, are we positioned to compete? I think one could argue that 49% might be a little bit on the high side. And similarly, as we look at the frequency of payments, we have about two-thirds on either a daily or weekly basis, but about half of the companies, and you could answer more than one here, about half the companies on a monthly basis, which from a representative standpoint, that may or may not be too infrequent. So it might be something to look at as we move forward. 8 out of 10 companies ship directly to consumers outside the network. And as Judy was pointing out earlier on in the presentation, given the Amazonification, shipping expectations of consumers have evolved. So you'll see about half of us, half the consumer shipments are determined by the dollar amount of that order. 40% are a flat fee, and about a quarter determined by weight. As we flip to the next page, the cost of shipping, so from a representative standpoint, you'll see those percentages on the right-hand side of the page, pretty similar to the consumer perspective. But as we look at the left side, the cost of shipping and handling, we'll see how that's evolved from 2013 to 2017, give or take about half the companies break even for shipping and handling, but that number has increased over the past 4 or 5 years, whereas the number of companies that actually make money on shipping and handling has been reduced. Okay. So hopefully that was a helpful, quick overview of the findings. Judy, I think I'm turning it back over to you.
Yes, Jay, thank you. It's really helpful to have your perspective on all this and the perspective of New Avon, so thank you. And also, Jay, I think you've posed a lot of ideas for how direct selling companies might respond, and also some questions on which we may need to do some future research, and certainly questions for future discussion. So at this point, let's sort of buzz through a quick summary of what this means to us. Now, first of all, we see that Amazon is king. No surprise. The impact of this is that consumer expectations have really changed. And what is needed in terms of the industry right now are not the small incremental changes, but the transformational changes needed to really remain relevant in this marketplace. We need to update ordering, payment, fulfillment systems to really meet that on-demand desire and reality today. And experimentation with other innovative approaches is very much apropos and learning to fail fast. We know also that it's a tech takeover, that e-commerce and collaborative economy are all tech-based. And so it's important for us all to prioritize and to fully leverage the potential of technology, CRM, of social media, and to provide our representatives with personal websites and other tech solutions that will help facilitate their business building. We need to develop mechanisms to track online transactions. As a differentiator, we know that direct selling has its strong relationships. High tech is very important, yes, but we have to leverage the high touch as well. It is our strong suit. There will always be a need for personal interaction and a continued need for in-person recommendations and demonstrations that you can't get in any Walmart store. We need to research, though, to understand our consumers' needs. And we need to get that technology in the hands of our independent representatives who are literally on the go and mobile to leverage the personal service that we know we can provide. And finally, the metrics are missing for this new age. Understanding the product and service consumers is really key. We've got to be able to segment and to use CRM to help maximize the performance. We need to implement mechanisms to track online transactions and how effective social media actually is. We need to understand and track acquisition and retention costs. And we really need a complete toolkit of KPIs to track progress towards our strategic goals. And wow, as we look at this, KPIs and metrics are a perfect segue to the Growth and Outlook Survey, which is now in the field. I'd like to talk just a little bit about this because this is our next big push. As we look at the 2018 research objectives for Growth and Outlook, it is always to size and measure the direct selling industry in the United States. More recently, it has also been a survey in which we quantify the overall sales force, and for the past few years, we have been segmenting that sales force of people involved in direct selling into the various segments. We also use Growth and Outlook to compare the U.S. direct selling industry to broader macroeconomic indicators like GDP, unemployment, consumer expectations, retail sector performance, and so on. This study, as I said, will allow us to better segment the people involved and to understand what percent of direct sellers are focused on business building on a full-time versus a part-time basis, and who are more focused at purchasing at levels for consumption inside their own households. We're also beginning this year and last to capture data on preferred customers and to see how that group is growing. All of this year's results will be presented at DSA's annual meeting in San Diego, California, taking place this year from June 17th to 19th. And so let's move forward now to understand what the benefits of the Growth and Outlook Survey are to you, to your company, and to the industry. And to really comment on this, we'd like to hear from Joe Mariano, who can tell us something about how DSA uses all of this information in advocacy efforts. Joe, over to you for a moment.
Well, thanks, Judy, and thank you and Jay as well for all of the comprehensive information. I mean, you know, as we see and hear all of this data, it's actually remarkable, and I know there's a lot more in the DSA research portfolio, both that we've done, that we are doing, and that we will do in the future. And all of this information, and that additionally, I should say, provided by the Direct Selling Education Foundation and some of the academic fellows who work with us using this data, is extraordinarily helpful on two fronts. First, in calls like this, obviously, to our internal constituents of DSA members, using this information as benchmarks for your own individual companies to get a sense of what's happening among your colleagues and competitors, what's happening in the field, what's happening overall with the growth of the industry, allows you to get out of your own corporate bubble, if you will, and really compare yourself to the rest of the industry and identify trends that might be helpful in developing your business strategy. So that's sort of the internal purpose, if you will, of all of our data gathering and analysis. The external purposes, however, and I think there's a slide later on in the presentation from my annual meeting remarks that talks about this, the growth and outlook survey, and for that matter, really everything that we were just talking about, the segmentation questions, with the payment approaches, what companies know about their non-distributor customers and access to that information, all of this is absolutely and critically related to DSA's public affairs legislative and self-regulatory agenda, which you'll hear a little bit later on about in the presentations. This information is really the only credible information that exists about the direct selling channel. When we go to state capitals, when we speak to the press, importantly now when we speak to people here in Washington, D.C., about the questions of what's a legitimate business model for direct selling, what is the personal use of product by individual distributors, what do our companies know and what can we say about customers outside of the marketing plan, what are the rates of satisfaction, how much are we as the direct selling channel contributing in to the economic well-being of our communities by virtue of the number of salespeople, the number of estimated retail sales, the amount of estimated retail sales, and similar items. Without this data, we cannot be a credible source for outside audiences. Without this data, you cannot function as efficiently as you might if you were dealing with this in a vacuum. So the efforts of the committee, our colleagues and the executive ranks of our companies, our outside research partners, all of them are absolutely critical to the fundamental core activities of the association. So without this data, we would be far less powerful, far less influential, far less persuasive, and would be lacking a significant and critical tool in our advocacy efforts. So again, Judy, Jay, Paul, and everyone who's been involved, thank you for continuing to arm us. And perhaps even more importantly, thank you for all of those of you who have participated in the survey gathering information. If you do not participate, frankly, you are crippling yourselves and to a degree the association in our ability to advocate on your behalf. So please consider participating in the future in any way possible and as much as possible. John Webb is sitting here, and Brian Bennett, who you know are active in our government relations efforts, and I know you both use the data all the time, both in generality and as well as some specifics in state capitals and in Washington, D.C. So, Judy?
Yes, Joe, thank you so much for explaining all the uses, both at the industry level and at the level of the companies. And now, in the interest of time, we'd like to turn things over to Paul Borquin, who is our outside third-party vendor. And Paul is managing economist at Nathan Associates. Paul is going to give us some tips for completing the questionnaire and submitting it this year. So, Paul, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Judy. So let me go over the four tips on this slide. First tip, before completing on the online survey, download and read the PDF of the questionnaire. See what information needs to be collected with you in your company and from what departments. It helps to start early and to set timelines for the people you're collecting information from eternally. Second tip, unavoidably, DSA has two separate surveys in the field with member companies right now, the annual growth and outlook survey, which we're discussing now, and the quarterly data tracker survey. Occasionally, companies get these surveys confused. You might want to touch base, maybe through a meeting, with any colleagues that help you with these surveys to make sure everyone understands they are separate surveys and that everyone's on the same page as to what information is needed and when. A third tip, you can complete the online survey in multiple sittings. Data are saved as you key them into the online survey form. So, for example, you can stop at any time during the survey, close your browser, shut off your computer, and the next day you can return to the survey using the link that was sent to you and pick up right where you left off. Last tip, after you click the submit button at the end of the online survey, you will see on your screen a listing of your responses. I strongly encourage you to download or print that for your files. It will make it easier to complete the survey next year, and it will help if I need to contact you about some of your answers. The next slide has a quick review of the survey schedule. Surveys were distributed on January 12th. The submission deadline is March 9th. Top line results will be presented at the annual meeting in San Diego in early June. And finally, the survey report will go out to survey participants sometime in June or July. Now with the next slide, let me summarize the survey process. Regarding the four bulleted topics on the right hand of the slide, for data collection, all individual company data are treated confidentially by Nathan Associates as specified in a confidentiality agreement between DSA and Nathan Associates. Survey findings are reported only in the aggregate with no identification of companies participating in the survey. Survey data from companies are collected primarily through the online survey, but some companies send their submission by email. In terms of vetting, individual company submissions are reviewed for irregular answers. For example, the questionnaire asks for a percentage distribution of sales by product and by sales strategy, and we check to see if these percent distributions sum to 100%. Also, a company's data are compared to other information about the company, such as last year's submission to the survey, if any. If a company, for instance, says this year that 100% of its sales are made through a person-to-person sales strategy, but last year said that 100% were made through a party plan strategy, then I'll contact that company to clarify that information. In aggregating the information, the survey data are cross-tabulated by three company characteristics: primary sales method, annual retail sales, and age. These crosstabs are included in the results report so you can compare your company against its peers. If you have a possible interest in receiving customized crosstabs with your company data for a small fee, you can indicate that in a question on that topic at the end of the questionnaire. In addition, as Judy mentioned before, the survey data are also used along with other secondary research to size the entire U.S. direct selling channel in terms of retail sales and number of distributors and some other characteristics. For analysis, the results report shows trending information by year on estimated direct sales in total and by product category, sales strategy, and region. Similarly, the report provides trending information on the U.S. direct sales force in total and by demographics and on recruitment and attrition. To provide context, the report broadly compares the performance of U.S. direct selling against global direct selling and against the overall U.S. economy. And on the next slide, if at any time you have any questions at all about the Growth and Outlook Survey, please contact Ben or myself. This slide presents our contact information. And with that, Joe, I'll turn things back over to you.
Well, thank you so much. Again, a lot of information, Paul. Thank you. Appreciate everything. I want to take this opportunity to give anybody a chance to ask questions or pose some comments to our three presenters on research and data. We will go to our next session in a moment. If you'd like to unmute your line, please hit *6. And then to remute, hit *6 again. So if there are any questions, you can submit those online or now via the telephone. Don't all rush at once. Come on. I think that frequently this volume of data is actually a little bit daunting to people. Judy, could you describe a little bit about the availability of this data? I know we sent these presentations out in conjunction with the meeting, but how do company executives get access to this and to do a little bit deeper dive on some of the specific details of it?
Absolutely, Joe. Well, basically, it's really important for a company to participate because that's the only way to get the entire report in the entire data set. As well, as Paul mentioned, it's important to participate because you can also get a special version of the report with your own data that you can set alongside the overall industry data for comparison purposes. That can be very useful. So yes, it's important to participate in order to receive entire data. Now that said, we do present excerpts of the data at various industry conferences like the Fall Conference and this DSA Live. So we do try to provide some general idea of the data to member companies. Any questions from the group? It is very daunting to hear this much. Maybe we should turn things back to you for presentation by the government affairs staff, and then maybe people will have thought of other questions by the end of the call.
Absolutely. That's what we'll do. I have to tell you, Judy, you've got a very good radio presentation. You could be a DJ or something with your articulation and elocution. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Joe.
So let's do as Judy suggested and go to the next section, portion of our agenda, the so-called legislative update into ethics and self-regulation programs. I'll actually switch those around a little bit and do ethics and self-regulation first. I think that's the order of our slides in any case. But before we started the call, you know, I was talking to my colleagues here on staff, and I said, I want to hear two words with regard to the new Direct Selling Association ethics initiatives that we will describe in a moment, and that's bold and ambitious. And I really do think that that's the case. I think the things that the DSA leadership at the board level and our executive committee have articulated and endorsed are indeed bold and ambitious steps with the ultimate goal of improving the reputation of direct sellers in the marketplace, of answering some of the myths, misunderstandings, and misrepresentations which we know have existed and probably will continue to exist about our direct selling channel. They come from competitors, they come from people who haven't been involved, and in some instances, they come and are generated by perceptions of activities in the marketplace that may have some grounding in reality. So as a result, the association has undertaken over many years, going back to the 1970s, a clear, articulated goal and objective of being the most progressive trade association representing the most progressive consumer-oriented industry in the country. That dates back to the 1970s, for goodness sake, as does the existing DSA Code of Ethics. But it's become clear to us that as much as we have patted ourselves on the back as an industry and indeed dealt with problems perceived and real in the marketplace, that our reputation has not necessarily kept pace with our existing self-regulatory efforts. This was particularly evident over the last several years as somewhat high-profile actions were taken against direct selling companies, both members and non-members, and really revealed some of those misunderstandings and myths and misrepresentations that I was talking about. So John Parker, the current DSA chairman from Amway, said something at a meeting a year or two ago that I think a lot of the other leaders and company leaders took to heart. Certainly we did at the association staff level, and that is that as good as our self-regulation and this code of ethics program has been, that we could not continue to just say, yeah, this is sufficient, that it had not done enough to answer some of those concerns in the marketplace. So the time was now ripe, not for evolution, but revolution in our approach. So what is that revolution? As we go into 2019, next year, we will be working towards the implementation of a new program based upon the input that you all as members have given the association, the observations we've made from the press and others, but also importantly from the Federal Trade Commission. Acting Chair Olhausen of the commission told us in late 2017, again, what the FTC, what she looked for in effective self-regulatory programs and why this is important. And even as the regulatory pressures, some of the regulatory pressures on the industry seem to be lessening, it is still absolutely critical for the association to continue to move forward and enhance its existing self-regulatory program. What are the things that the FTC is looking for? A number of things. Commitment and buy-in from the industry as a whole. Thus, we have continue to have these outreach sessions, and we'll continue to seek your input as well as describe some of the potential programs that we're talking about. Adequate funding mechanisms and independence from the industry, absolutely critical in making sure that consumer or salesperson or other complaints are answered effectively. Standards that are clear, meaningful, fair, and ultimately effective enforcement mechanisms. And something that's not on this slide is also a matter of transparency. Reporting, everyone, the public at large, consumers, salespeople, other people in the industry, and of course the government, knowing what this self-regulatory system is and how problems and issues are resolved. Now, this builds on the existing initiatives and activities of the association, not only of the last several years, but really many decades, but even over the last particular couple of years. The Ethics and Self-Regulation Committee Board and others have been really quite active in stepping up our self-regulatory program even before this 2018-19 initiative. I look at the graphic here on the screen. I'm going to start at the end point. What we've really been trying to achieve through our recent efforts is to get to greater levels of membership-wide code of ethics compliance, to foster dialogue with third-party validators, to continue to elevate DSA member companies in the marketplace, their reputation with particularly policymakers. How have we done that in the last several years? Ensuring a more proactive approach towards enforcement and compliance, instituting social media monitoring, corporate monitoring by the Code of Ethics Administrator himself, not merely responding to complaints that might come in to the tune of 150 or 200 or so a year, but really going out in the marketplace and looking at overall compliance. Now, again, I don't want to suggest by virtue of this that there's widespread non-compliance by member companies or, for that matter, our field. But in order to have effective self-regulatory mechanisms, we have to do more, and we have to be seen to be doing more. Of course, many of you know that we, in 2017, completed a 100% review of DSA membership with emphasis on earnings claims and products substantiation, as well as overall structural issues with companies, and not only looking at corporate materials and websites, but enhancing that and increasing that standard by looking at social media used by our sales force. Outside information that is from outside sources, including non-governmental organizations like Truth in Advertising, National Consumers League, and others, has also been built into this review process so that however credible, incredible, or accurate or inaccurate that information may be, it is a basis of the evaluation of a company's marketing activities and a Salesforce marketing activities by the code administrator and by DSA staff. So all of these things have been taking place, but now what happens next? Again, our ultimate goal is elevating the reputation of DSA members in the direct selling channel and thus eliminating the need or perceived need for government intrusion into what we do and government over-regulation of what we do. We have to make sure our own house is in order. So we are drawing upon the existing legacy, 40 years plus, of self-regulation that has been lauded, by the way, by the Federal Trade Commission and others as a good example of what needs to be done, even though more can be done. We want to strengthen and raise the bar by evaluating new standards for ethical business practices by direct selling companies, thus enhancing the value of association membership and, in fact, the business channel for direct selling companies. And how are we going to do that? By forming a stronger, more comprehensive program with additional expertise, third-party credibility, identification of appropriate and inappropriate industry practices, public reporting like that which I've described, and the far encompassing reach of this standard to not only DSA members, but even potentially non-members of the association. Obviously, again, this goal is to have a stronger value for association membership and being in the business model and ultimately precluding some of the things that have taken place. Now, this is to go in hand with our government affairs priorities and a strong and clear regulatory and legal standard, which we'll talk about in just a moment. But I want to give you a little bit more specificity with regard to the next steps of the program and what we see happening over the course of 2018 and into 2019. We hope by the end of the 2018, even into the fourth quarter of this year, we will have implemented at least a pilot program of cooperation with an outside third party. We have entered into a current memorandum of understanding with the Council of Business Bureaus and the so-called ASRC, a self-regulatory organization that exists for advertising, built upon some of the models that other organizations have created with the Council of Better Business Bureau, and to work in conjunction with the code administrator for systemic review of DSA companies, and again, potentially even non-member companies, on broader issues through statistical sampling, specific complaints, and other matters that may be brought to the attention of the council and or the code administrator. The goal here is to, in fact, bring the value and brand of this third party and the credibility of existing systems, which work in collaboration and in close collaboration with the Federal Trade Commission and other organizations, to give even more teeth, more value, and perceived value to the DSA code. We are currently setting out in discussions like this and with CEOs of our companies a series of meetings to get input on how what this program will look like with some great degree of detail to also describe the initial plans and what we think a program might look like based upon these other templates. Once adopted by the DSA board, if indeed it is adopted, as we expect it would be, for implementation later this year and into 2019, there will be a time frame of adjustment through 2019 for companies to come into whatever degree of compliance might be additionally necessary for any new standards, but also to become familiar with this new third-party entity working cooperatively with DSA. Again, DSA members would be affected, but would have a special voice in creation of and enhancing any structure or standards. But the new system, once implemented, might very well apply to non-members, as does the current standards for something like the Advertising Standards Review Council that I mentioned earlier. So we're very enthusiastic about the potential for assisting us in the marketplace. There is an element of adjustment that will be necessary ultimately to whatever program comes into place. But that's what the purposes of our outreach over the next 3 weeks, 3 months, 6 months, and indeed next year will be. You will see members of the executive committee board, the management team, senior management team, the Council of Better Business Bureaus visiting regionally around the country. We are setting up a series of meetings and dinners for the major hubs of direct selling so that we can meet with you, your CEOs, and other interested parties to describe the program or the potential program, get your input into it, target that. A special working group has been appointed by John Parker, chairman of the DSA board, to flesh out this and working in detail with the Ethics and Self-Regulation Committee. And before adoption by the full board, we will have another final conclave of direct selling executives from outside of the board to give final input and perfection of the plan as we present it to the board for a vote later this year. So that is the plan. As I said, it works hand-in-hand with our government relations and legislative agenda. I'm going to hand it over to Brian Bennett and my sickly colleague, John Webb, who just sneezed, to talk about our legislative agenda, because it is important and critical to know that while we are enhancing our self-regulatory standards, we are also pursuing, on a continuing basis, a greater clarity in law with regard to a number of these issues. So, Brian Bennett, John Webb. Brian, I think you're going to take it off.
Yeah, no, thanks, Joe, and thanks, Judy, Jay, Paul, and everyone on the phone. I just want to kind of, I know we're short on time, just want to emphasize what Joe was saying earlier. I think we want to focus right now this year and in the future on data-driven lobbying and, you know, really amplify these numbers. You know, we're very fortunate here at DSA to have a research component that operates yearly. There are not very many associations in the Washington, D.C. area that have yearly updates on numbers and things like that. Usually they're every 3 to 5 years. So I think it's important in the advocacy efforts and to amplify our self-regulation priorities as well. One bullet I want to talk about kind of that builds into these that's not up here, I just want to talk about it very briefly. On January 4th, the Federal Trade Commission issued business guidance concerning multi-level marketing, is how they entitled it. A detailed analysis will be going out very shortly by the end of the day today, but just on a 50,000-foot level, this is non-binding guidance to help, as the FTC described it, multi-level marketers apply core principles of business practices to consumer protection. There are some very positive developments in here, including the FTC saying that personal use of the products by the sales force is not in itself indicative of an unlawful compensation structure. That builds into the legislative priorities that I'll talk about in a second. We have done detailed calls on this business guidance with the relevant committees, the Government Relations Committee, the Ethics and Self-Regulation Committee, the Lawyers Council, the General Counsel Committee, among others. But a detailed analysis will be going out to a broader swing of membership a little later today, I think by COB. That builds into our legislative priorities. First, on Capitol Hill, H.R. 3409, which is the Anti-Pyramid Protection Act of 2017. As many of you know, introduced by Congressman Marsha Blackburn from Tennessee, Congressman Mark Vesey from Texas. Right now it is 36 bipartisan co-sponsors. That's 23 Republicans and 13 Democrats. I actually did a little number crunching earlier today. This has more co-sponsors than about 94% of bills on the House side. So I think having that bipartisan support is extremely important. A little bit on the substance, as Joe kind of described, would provide clarity for enforcement by the FTC in the marketplace. First of all, would clearly define a pyramid scheme under federal statute, looking at the compensation structure, whether that structure of the compensation is primarily based on recruitment as opposed to the sale of the products. Secondly, supported by the FTC guidance, make clear that personal use of products by the sales force is legitimate business practice, as well as mandate a 90% inventory buyback policy for all direct selling companies. Now, that's the standalone legislation, not to use some D.C. speak here. That's the standalone legislation. It's very tough to get kind of a standalone bill passed through the House. So we've been working with Josephine Mills and Teresa Flores before her and the Government Relations Committee to explore another vehicle to get similar language done. And that vehicle is in appropriations language, essentially bills that fund the government. Now, I know everyone probably heard about the short-lived shutdown that we had for a couple days here in D.C. and over the weekend that led into this week. A little bit of background, there is very similar language offered by Congressman John Molinar, Republican from Michigan, in a appropriations package all the way back in July. We would hope that that language would be considered and is being considered. It passed the full House of Representatives in September. Unfortunately, no final funding package has been approved by the U.S. House and U.S. Senate to this point. Essentially, the shutdown was resolved by what's called a continuing resolution. Essentially, we have been operating under such continuing resolution since October 1st. This is an agreement to fund the government at the current level. These continuing resolutions usually don't have any provisions in them that speak to policy. There are some exceptions to that. I think the most recent one had something in it, but essentially Congress has kicked the can down the road to next month, February 8th. However, they're probably kicked the can down the road again, from what I hear. I think that the three-week period was not long enough for them to kind of work out all the final numbers and everything, so we'll probably see another continuing resolution after February 8th, probably for another month. But we continue to work on passage and enactment of not only the House bill, but support of the Molinar Amendment language, as we're calling it, as well as possible introduction of a Senate bill with similar language. That moves me to the next part, which has been enacted into federal law. A lot of people probably heard last year a big tax reform package. It's called H.R. 1, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Was passed by the House and Senate, signed by the President last year. A lot of the elements of this don't take effect until 2019 filing, but right now DSA is going to do a detailed analysis of the implications of this tax package for direct selling companies. That includes analysis of how it would affect big corporations, small corporations, medium-sized corporations, family-owned businesses, and more importantly, I think, the effect on your independent contractor sales force. We've been talking to tax experts around town and doing our own analysis right now. I won't go too far. I don't want to get too far ahead of my skis because I'm not a tax expert, but just kind of reading some of the things that tax experts I've spoken to have said, that there could be a beneficial value in here for independent contractors through a pass-through entity. If you're a self-employed individual, if your taxable income does not exceed $157,500 a year. That is the extent of my knowledge. I know a little more. Again, I don't want to get ahead of my skis, but If there's anything else that I know, I see we have a lot of tax folks on the phone. If there's anything else that you think DSA needs to be looking at in the tax reform package for impact on your companies or your distributors, please let myself or John Webb here on the DSA public affairs staff know. Last thing, last bullet before I kind of see if there's any other comments or questions from John or Joe. We're also working priorities on the state level as well. I mentioned consumer protection legislation that we're working on the federal level. Primarily in past years, we've worked this kind of legislation on the state level. We are continuing to do that on the state level. I think there are three states right now that have bills introduced, one carrying over from last year, Ohio, but Iowa and Mississippi also have bills that have been introduced similar to the federal language to create this clarity in state law as well. We are working on a couple of other states with the appropriate offices in those states to get bills introduced and hopefully enacted this year. Last thing, then I'll stop talking, preservation of independent contractor status, extremely important, not only on the state level, but on the federal level as well. I know John may be able to speak to this a little more, but we are working on legislation this year, carrying over from last year, specifically in North Carolina, that would specifically define direct sellers as independent contractors under the North Carolina Unemployment Compensation Code, tracking the language in 26 U.S.C. 3508. There's been similar language enacted in 37 states. Another state we are working on this year is Oregon. Oregon is one of those 37 states. Unfortunately, that direct seller exemption is currently awaiting ruling by the Oregon Supreme Court that it did not apply to a direct selling company, ACN. But that's kind of our very quick rundown of federal and state legislative and government affairs priorities. John or Joe, I don't know if you have anything else.
I'll go first, and then John can add to some of his specifics. With regard to the independent contractor issue
specifically, I don't think anybody can take credit for anything that is or isn't in the tax reform package that passed, given the political dynamic that took place. But I do want to give a shout-out to the Government Relations Committee, Teresa Flores, and then Josephine Mills, for the proactive agenda that we've had over the last 2 years, talking to members of Congress, and, of course, this new Congress particularly, with regard to independent contractor status. While we have spent a lot of time on the consumer protection anti-pyramid issues, one of the issues or one of the items that we brought to the attention of lawmakers here in Washington was don't do anything to harm independent contractor direct sellers. Don't do anything to undermine legitimate use of independent contractors. And indeed, aside from some of the more peripheral business issues and that may be related to independent contractor issues and S-Corps and similar things, the reality is that I think we were ultimately successful in making sure that there was no specific rejiggering or way of changing the status of independent contractors under this package. Now, of course, there's still a lot there, and we'll do further analysis, but it's clear that some of the proposals were not enacted and were not part of this deal. Additionally, the Government Relations Committee has set up a sub-working group to talk about how we might actually explore over the course of the remainder of this Congress for the next 8 months, 9 months, year technically, what might be done under the existing Fair Labor Standards Act or other similar laws beyond income tax where direct sellers do not currently have a specific exemption from coverage of those laws. We are effectively exempt, but not necessarily specifically pursuant to statute. So that is something that we are exploring, and the Government Relations Committee will continue to work on. John, you've been very diligent on both the independent contractor front as well as the pyramid front, particularly at the state level. Any updates you want to share?
Well, no, the only thing I'll add is that, sometimes we may talk a lot about the pyramid efforts, which are extremely important. We're still very committed to continue moving forward in the states that either have an unperfected exemption, as Brian mentioned, in Oregon or in North Carolina. We're speaking a specific direct seller definition for unemployment comp, very similar to the 3508 language we have at the federal level. And we'll continue to move forward in those states, 13 or so now, where we don't have those. That's important. I know it's important to a lot of companies. Preservation of independent contractor status is really a key and the bread and butter of what we do. We're going to continue to move forward on those efforts in North Carolina, Oregon, and other states.
And Brian, you just got back from a meeting yesterday, I guess, of our coalition, or 2 days ago, with our D.C.-based coalition, which DSA has been a leader of for many years, for entrepreneurship and specifically independent contractor status of other industries. Any news coming out of that meeting?
No, I think just this is the it's called the Coalition to Promote Independent Entrepreneurs. It's a group of independent contractor kind of companies that utilize independent contractors, trade associations that, similar to DSA, have a very specific interest and focus on independent contractors, the realtors, the truckers, the bakers, the builders, things like that. It sounds like a poem, but that's kind of just some of the groups that are involved. I think their main kind of legislative priority this year is passage of legislation. I think the number is H.R. 3825 that would create a little more clarity. Joe mentioned the sub-working group on the Fair Labor Standards Act. This would create a little more clarity, I think, generally under the Fair Labor Standards Act. However, as Joe mentioned, we are kind of convening a subgroup chaired by Alexis Ginn from Primerica that would specifically address the direct seller status under the Fair Labor Standards Act. So that's kind of the only update from that. They're continuing to work that, and we're part of the coalition. And yeah, I think we have a – Joe says 8 months. I think in reality it's about 90 days before they kind of go into reelect mode. So
yeah, exactly.
But I know going to – kind of time, we have one more slide, Ben. Kind of tying this all back together, it's extremely important, I think, that, you know, we, as Joe mentioned, we're here in Washington, D.C. for a reason. We represent direct selling on Capitol Hill or in state capitals, but still extremely important for member companies and distributors to have their voice heard as well. It's extremely beneficial for us to walk into an office with a constituent letter from someone in that state or in that district, not only the data, which is also important, but a constituent letter so they can draw a real connection to the issue. So we do have a direct selling advocacy center you can access via the DSA.org website. Right now, this is set up to send letters in support of H.R. 3409. Hopefully, when a Senate bill is introduced, if I click my heels 3 times and keep saying it, hopefully it'll come true. They can send letters. It's a preformed, just have to fill out their name and their address, and then a letter is pre-written for them. If they want to customize it, that's great, but this really is one more thing that goes a long way into helping DSA's advocacy efforts here in D.C. and state capitals.
Thank you, Brian. We're at the beyond our normal time, but I do want to give a couple extra minutes for questions. A lot of information, again, from Judy and her colleagues, and as well as Brian. So questions, now is the time to ask it. If somebody does ask, is the first person to ask the question, I'll even send you a special DSA pin, for lapel pin. So, but you have to ask a question in order to get it. Again, unmute yourself by *6 because I'm sure you're all laughing hilariously now at that clever little jab. Well, hearing no questions then, Melissa Brunton, our Senior Vice President for Education, who's sitting here at the table with me, is going to get the pin. So there you go. I do want to thank all of my colleagues here at DSA and all of you. And, again, special thanks to our research crew, Jay, Judy, Paul, and indeed the entire committee for all your hard work. So we'll keep you updated as we go forward. Please look for information about our regional meetings on the Ethics and Self-Regulation Program. Look for more information with regard to research and your participation in that from Ben Gamsey here on staff, whom I failed to mention. Sorry, Ben, who's also done a yeoman job, as well as our legislative and self-regulatory efforts from the legal team here at DSA. So thank you all. Take care, and we'll see you soon.